But Beatrice Blaine, there was a woman. Early pictures taken on her father's estate at Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, or in Rome at the Sacred Heart Convent, an educational extravagance that in her youth was only for the daughters of the exceptionally wealthy, showed the exquisite delicacy of her features, the consummate art and simplicity of her clothes. A brilliant education she had, her youth passed in Renaissance glory. She was versed in the latest gossip of the older Roman families, known by name as a fabulously wealthy American girl to Cardinal Vittori and Queen Margherita, and more subtle celebrities that one must have had some culture even to have heard of. She learned in England to prefer whiskey and soda to wine, and her small talk was broadened in two senses during a winter in Vienna. All in all, Beatrice O'Hara absorbed the sort of education that will be quite impossible ever again, a tutelage measured by the number of things and people one could be contemptuous of and charming about, a culture rich in all arts and traditions, barren of all ideas. In the last of those days when the great gardener clipped the inferior roses to produce one perfect bud. In her less important moments, she returned to America, met Stephen Blaine, and married him. This almost entirely because she was a little bit weary, a little bit sad. Her only child was carried through a tiresome season and brought into the world on a spring day in 96. When Amory was 5, he was already a delightful companion for her. He was an auburn-haired boy with great handsome eyes which he would grow up to in time, a facile, imaginative mind, and a taste for fancy dress. From his 4th to his 10th year, he did the country with his mother in her father's private car, from Coronado, where his mother became so bored that she had a nervous breakdown in a fashionable hotel, down to Mexico City, where she took a mild, almost epidemic consumption. This trouble pleased her, and later she made use of it as an intrinsic part of her atmosphere, especially after several astounding bracers. So while more or less fortunate little rich boys were defying governesses on the beach at Newport, or being spanked or tutored or read to from Do and Dare, or Frank on the Mississippi, Amory was biting acquiescent bellboys in the Waldorf, outgrowing a natural repugnance to chamber music and symphonies, and deriving a highly specialized education from his mother. Amory? Yes, Beatrice? Such a quaint name for his mother, she encouraged it. Dear, don't think of getting out of bed yet. I've always suspected that early rising in early life makes one nervous. Clotilde is having your breakfast brought up.
All right.
I am feeling very old today, Amory, she would sigh, her face a rare cameo of pathos, her voice exquisitely modulated, her hands as facile as Bernhard's. My nerves are on edge, on edge. We must leave this terrifying place tomorrow and go searching for sunshine. Amory's penetrating green eyes would look out through tangled hair at his mother. Even at this age, he had no illusions about her. Amory?
Oh, yes.
I want you to take a red-hot bath, as hot as you can bear it, and just relax your nerves. You can read in the tub if you wish. She fed him sections of the Fête Galante before he was 10. At 11, he could talk glibly, if rather reminiscently, of Brahms and Mozart and Beethoven. One afternoon, when left alone in the hotel at Hot Springs, he sampled his mother's apricot cordial, and as the taste pleased him, he became quite tipsy. This was fun for a while, but he essayed a cigarette in his exaltation and succumbed to a vulgar plebeian reaction. Though this incident horrified Beatrice, it also secretly amused her and became part of what in a later generation would have been termed her line. This son of mine, he heard her tell a room full of awestruck, admiring women one day, is entirely sophisticated and quite charming,